When it comes to making a big decision, buying a house, say, or making a career change, how do you decide? Is it research, 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 or do you just go with your gut?
Our next guest says a lot of us have very different ways of making decisions, and that research says our decision-making style can have a big impact on our happiness.
Elizabeth Bernstein joins us. She writes the Bonds column on relationships for the Wall Street Journal, and we've posted her piece on decision-making over at the Central Time Facebook page. Elizabeth, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So you focus in that piece on two different styles of decision-making. What are they?
Exactly. There's two main styles, according to researchers. The first is called maximizers, and those are people who like to take their time with a decision. They like to weigh every single option they can. They're looking for the very, very best decision out there. So that's number one. Second type is satisficers, and these people would rather be fast than super thorough. And they still have high standards, but, you know, good enough is okay for them. They want to make a decision that's good for them and move on.
Did you make these terms up, or do they exist out there?
They exist out there. This is, you know, years and years of research, believe it or not.
Okay.
And satisficers, which seems, kind of a silly word, is actually a mashup of satisfy and suffice. It is a word.
So it seems like, you know, it's probably a spectrum style thing where some people fall in the middle, but there are also people at the extreme ends. What do we know about the different people and where they fall?
Well, we know that most people, as you say, do fall in the middle. And in fact, we can be a satisficer on some decisions. You know, we might be able to look at a restaurant menu and decide quickly, but if we're going to buy a car, we're a maximizer, we're going to take forever and figure it out. So we can sort of mix up our styles as well. But what we do know is, you know, people tend to fall into somewhere on the spectrum, one or the other. And maximizers, it's very interesting. They may make better decisions, but they are not as happy. The maximizers are actually more depressed, less satisfied with life. That's what the research shows.
Yeah, so what's the deal with that? I mean, and I think you cite research that says maximizers can make more money too, so they get better outcomes in some ways, they make better decisions. Why aren't they as happy as satisficers like me?
Because they always feel there's going to be another decision. They're driving themselves crazy, really. They always feel that there's going to be some other option they didn't look into. There could have been another decision they could have made. They always have this feeling that, you know, I didn't check every single box. There must be something else out there that could be better than what I have.
It's interesting, too, you write about how people who are maximizers do win in that they have better jobs, it sounds like, but they're not as happy about it.
They're just not as happy. So what you're referring to is a study that looked at college students and their first job out, and the maximizers actually got, if I remember correctly, 20%. The salary was 20% higher when they were done finding their first jobs than the satisficers. Yet when you went back after a period of time and asked all of them, satisficers and maximizers, who was happiest, the satisficers, the ones who had settled, sort of, were actually much happier.
Now, you have a short assessment quiz in the article. I took it. I had a 3 out of 13, which puts me way on the satisficer side, which I think surprises no one. Did you try it, Elizabeth? And if so, how did you come out on
it? I did. I'm way on the satisficer side as well. I think you'd almost have to be to have the reporter's deadlines. You have to be able to push that button and move on.
Yeah, it's not friendly to a friendly world of perfectionists in the media world. You have to stop
No.
and meet a deadline sometime.
Exactly. You got to just...
Now, one of the places this comes into play is in relationships, partnerships between people, things like marriages and romantic relationships. How do people negotiate this kind of ground when they're together? And one might be a maximizer, wants to really make sure they pick the, say, perfect kitchen tile for the backsplash, and somebody else, you know, just wants to pick a nice one and move on.
Exactly. So can you imagine a house renovation or buying a car, something like this? This can be really tough. There's no research that shows who, matches up with whom. Who, you know, do satisficers and maximizers get together more often than satisficers and satisficers or maximizers and maximizers? The theory is that possibly it's better if you have one of each in a couple, because then you can actually get something done. But how do you make that decision then? You can really drive each other crazy if one person wants to move quickly and one person, you know, really doesn't feel comfortable till they weighed every option. That is really a sticky problem.
Columnist Elizabeth Bernstein from the Wall Street Journal is with us now talking about our decision-making styles and how they can even affect our happiness.
And you can join us. How do you make big decisions? Do you carefully weigh the options and analyze, or do you go with your gut and just get it over with quickly? Do you have trouble with coworkers or loved ones who decide things in a different style? And how do you navigate that territory? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We continue our conversation now with Elizabeth Bernstein. She writes the Bonds column on relationships at the Wall Street Journal. We're talking about decision making. She wrote a recent piece on it, and we have that linked on our Central Time Facebook page. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. How do you make decisions? Lots of research, weigh all the options, or just go with your gut and hope for the best. 800-642-1234 is the number to call or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll go to our callers now. Allie joins us from Elkhorn. Hi, Allie.
Hi.
What do you think of this?
I think that a satisfier and a maximizer in a relationship work very well together, because my husband and I are both opposite ends of the spectrum. I am very much so weigh all of my options. Working as an accountant, I'm very detail-oriented and think through everything. And he's a farmer. He has to make his quick decisions and know that it's just going to work. And I think the two of us have come to a really good compromise, and it makes everything stronger in the relationship.
And so you don't get impatient with one another because of your styles. You wanting to move on more quickly, and he wanting to take more time, or vice versa. You wanting to take more time.
Right. And we don't have that issue because we work in different fields that we don't have that conflict.
Well, opposites attract. In Allie's case, Elizabeth, did you see that playing out in a similar fashion with other people you spoke with?
I did. I see a lot of couples who will say exactly what Allie's saying, that, you know, we managed to figure it out. It wasn't always easy, though. Most couples say, you know, there was a learning curve, and we had to learn to figure it out. At first, we drove each other crazy, but in the end, yes, it works very well with one of each.
Allie, thanks a lot for the call. We go now to Erica on the line in Sparta. Hi, Erica.
Oh, hi there. My reaction was exactly the same as the previous caller. My husband and I are polar differences, and I, too, will take forever to decide, where he's a very quick thinker. But he was an air combat controller in the Navy, so that's a good thing, where I was an electronics technician, so everything had to be perfect before I said it was okay. So,
but Erica, I got to ask, are there situations where it leads to conflict, these two different styles?
Every single day. Today is our 13th anniversary, and so we've made it this far, and now, you know, it's we're fine. We have our fights, we're passionate people, but we always get over it, and we end up laughing.
Well, congratulations on your anniversary, Erica. Elizabeth, are there tips out there for people in the situation? We heard from a couple of people now on how to negotiate that difference and decide which impulse or opposite of impulse to work with. Elizabeth?
I'm sorry, you broke up there. I didn't hear what you asked me.
I was just saying, are there tips on how to negotiate the two different styles for people who are together and not have it lead to conflict?
Exactly. So one thing you may want to, as a couple, sort of understand, you know, who does this particular decision matter to most? And, you know, whoever that is, maybe let that person make the decision. If one person really, really cares about, you know, what kind of car you're going to share, and the other person doesn't care as much, let the maximizer decide. But also maybe narrow down the options together is another good plan, another good tip. If you could narrow down the options to, you know, say five or so together, then let the maximizer decide. They're going to, cross off all their boxes, and they're going to be happier.
Well, thank you for that call, Erica. And on to Dennis in Fond du Lac. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. My wife and I are opposites also. If I'm going to make it a purchase, whether it's a major purchase, small purchase, I can walk into a store, see what's there, and make a decision. My wife will, she's great. She does all kinds of research, but she really anguishes for so long to make a decision. And has led to occasional conflict because it just drives me crazy that she can't make a choice. But as far as Erica, she can hold on because we've been married 38 years. So,
All right. Well, thank you, Dennis. Appreciate that. And, you know, echoing what other callers have said, sometimes it drives them crazy, but they can find some common ground in the middle as well and keep going. But is there, Elizabeth, an optimal way to be? Is one of these, I guess, more happiness-inducing?
Well, definitely the research shows that satisficers are more happy. But, you know, you really kind of want to be in the middle because you want to make sure you're making good decisions and you are doing, you know, some research. You don't want to be somebody who just makes knee-jerk decisions. But you don't want to make so many decisions that, you know, opportunities pass, you know, it takes so long making that decision that opportunities pass you by or you're really driving yourself nuts. And one thing that I thought was interesting listening to the callers is we're hearing sort of from couples where the men are the satisficers.
Yeah.
And but that actually, it's interesting, but I also think that's just coincidence of those calling in right now. Research shows that really men and women are both satisficers and maximizers in equal numbers.
Interesting. I was just starting to see a trend there too, and that's true in my mm-hmm. life too. But no, we just had a weird random assortment there, you're saying.
Mm-hmm. That, yeah, sort of the odds of the callers.
All right. Dennis, thanks a lot. We'll go to Danielle with us now in Waukesha. Danielle, hi.
Hi there. I am wondering if you have any advice for us maximizers who drive ourselves crazy, because I over-research every decision that I make, and I see it in myself, and I spend so much time. And yes, I know I'm making myself crazy, but I can't seem to stop.
Well, Danielle, I'm glad you made a snap decision to call us anyway. Elizabeth, any advice for somebody who feels like they maximize too much?
Exactly. You want to maybe give yourself a deadline. So if you're going to, you know, a deadline that sort of works with whatever it is, you know, you don't want to give yourself a deadline of a day, obviously, if you're going to choose from a menu for dinner. But, you know, if you're buying a car, give yourself a week, give yourself, you know, a specific amount of time that is not as long as you would usually take, and then, you know, make the decision in there. Also, you know, you might want to ask for help for somebody you know. Ask your, if it's too stressful to ask the spouse, you know, ask your friend, ask somebody else who you really trust to sort of, you know, give you the deadline or help you decide how you could make that time shorter, that decision time shorter, and maybe look over a few options with you and narrow them down that way.
But how do you choose which friend? So you could do this with any decision.
You have to have a go-to friend. You got to take the time to decide that one, and then over and over you go to that person, I guess.
So does the type that we are change as we get older, or do we just sort of lock in on a type and that's what we are?
No, it does change. And in fact, again, the research shows that we become more like satisficers as we get older. So the theory is that we just sort of learn that, you know, good enough is good enough. I don't have to drive myself crazy, you know, that it's not worth really worrying about. And we just sort of become better at making decisions and trusting our instincts.
Let's go now to Christina with us in Green Bay. Christina, hi.
Hi there. The question that I'm wondering about is that I'm more of a maximizer in my work life and probably more of a satisficer in my home life. I'm looking for any kinds of tips that could help me become more of a satisficer in my work life to help me make quicker decisions at work.
Well, Christina, before we let you go, do you feel like you need to make quicker decisions, or do you do a type of work that maybe you should be a maximizer in?
Well, my work is more analytical, and I think that it fits there, but there are instances where I think that I should be quicker in my decision-making.
Interesting. Elizabeth, your thoughts on cutting down some maximization in the workplace in particular?
It is interesting. I'd be curious to know, you know, what Christina does at home that makes her, you know, more able to quickly make decisions or more quickly make them. If there's anything that, you know, she sort of knows about herself, the way she makes decisions in her personal life that she could carry over to her work life. And also if she could remind herself, you know, of times at work where she has made good decisions and they didn't take forever. So think of basically your successes, you know, that decision took appropriate amount of time and it was a good one and it worked out. So maybe build a little confidence that way so you can relax a little. It's probably, I'm guessing, feeling that the stakes are a little higher at work and that's why it's a little harder. So if you can sort of remind yourself, hey, I've done this before and I've made good decisions at work, maybe that would help.
And I wonder, Elizabeth, before we run out of time here, what if we have somebody who feels like they're too much of a satisficer and they want to maximize a little more? Any advice on moving in that direction?
they need to marry a maximizer. They need to quickly find a maximizer. You know, that's a very good question. I think, you know, same as if you're a maximizer and you give yourself a deadline to hurry up a little bit, maybe if you're a satisficer, make yourself look at, say, oh, I usually look at 3 options. This time I'm going to look at 6. Make yourself set a number of options that's higher than you usually look at and, you know, start to do a little bit more research.
Is part of this just learning, you know, if you want to lean more in the satisficer direction, to let go of the results a little bit, to allow yourself to buy the wrong toothpaste, for example, or, you know, maybe even the wrong car once in a while?
Yeah, I think it really is. It's, you know, there's this saying that I learned a long time ago, don't let perfect be the enemy of the good. And I always thought that that was a great saying because, you know, you can hold on for perfect and, you know, but meanwhile, you know, a lot of good decisions are passing you by.
Well, Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Elizabeth Bernstein, columnist of The Wall Street Journal. Her piece on decision-making is linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrer.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, a look at the ethical challenges and the real-life risks faced by war correspondents in places like Iraq and Syria.
First, we're talking about a constitutional amendment that's on the ballot tomorrow. If passed, money raised for transportation funding would be separated from the rest of the budget, so it couldn't be used for non-transportation purposes.
Sean Johnson is with us to give us the story behind that proposed amendment. He's WPR State Capitol reporter, and he joins us from the Capitol. Sean, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So if it were passed, what would this amendment do?
The simple answer is that it would lock down the transportation fund. You know, right now, the state has different funds to pay for different things. So a general fund is kind of like the state's checkbook, pays for schools, pays for health care, pays for prisons, pays for higher education. The transportation fund is more specific, pays for roads, transit, things like that. And up until now, and in fact still now, the state has had the ability, if it wanted, to transfer money back and forth between those funds, given the circumstances. What this transportation amendment would say is that when it comes to the transportation fund, you can no longer do that. That when revenues from something like the gas tax goes into the fund, it does not come out. It pays for roads.
So where exactly would the revenue for the fund come from?
The revenue would come from where it comes now. So, you know, like vehicle registration fees, gas taxes. The amendment that people are voting on doesn't actually add any new revenue. It just says that once that revenue is generated and it goes to the transportation fund, it's in there, and so that it can't get transferred out to another fund to pay any other bills but transportation. And the reason this is an issue partly is because in the last decade, the governor and legislature, primarily under Governor Jim Doyle, transferred a lot of money out of the transportation fund to the general fund to pay for schools during times of, I think it's fair to say, budget crisis. And so road builders didn't care for that, and they've really kind of led the charge to pass this amendment so that it can't happen again.
Now, why is this being pursued as a constitutional amendment?
Because the legislature can't really bind itself with laws. I mean, the legislature makes the laws, and so if they pass a law that says, don't do this anymore, the next legislature can simply say, well, we're going to pass a law to give ourselves a one-time exemption from that. So we can do it. I mean, it happens all the time with the budget itself. It's supposed to have so much money in the bank, a statutory balance of, I think, a couple percent. They waive that requirement every budget because they're not going to hit that number. So once it's in the Constitution, it's out of the legislature's hands. The road building lobby thinks that's a good thing, that, you know, these are dollars that should be locked down for roads from here forward. But the counter argument to that is that, you know, this should be the legislature's call. It should be the governor's call. And, you know, who's to say now here in 2014 that a legislature in 2018 or 2024 won't want to make a different decision?
And Fred Risser is one of those who is critical of this, saying it's and if it passed, it would prioritize transportation spending over other issues in Wisconsin. What do you make of that critique and whether it's got any traction going into the election tomorrow?
I'm not sure that it has traction just looking at the voting record for this proposal as it went through the legislature. I mean, it had pretty broad support when it came up this past session. And, you know, just quick review, to get a constitutional amendment on the ballot like this, it has to first pass two consecutive sessions of the legislature. It's done that. It did that in the Senate this past time by a vote of 25-8. So Fred Risser was one of those eight. But his concern, and remember, he's coming at this with more legislative experience than anyone in the country. He's also coming at it from the perspective of a Democrat in Dane County. He's saying that this is the legislature's call, that this is not where you should be amending the Constitution to tie future lawmakers' hands here. And, you know, his view also aligns with, you know, the teachers, for example, because ultimately when Jim Doyle transferred that money out of the road budget into the general fund during his administration, he said often that I'm doing this to prevent cuts to schools or prevent cuts to health care. So, you know, if we'd been in this situation under this amendment, Jim Doyle wouldn't have had those or that opportunity.
Are there other areas of the budget that are locked down like this and have to go expressly to a particular department like the transportation department should this pass?
I think that this would be the one that's constitutionally locked down in this way. I mean, there are other areas of the budget that are protected in law, and funds from X are supposed to go to Y. But again, lawmakers can waive that just like that. I mean, they don't have to. All they have to do is write a law, pass it that session, and they can always waive requirements that they put on themselves. They can't bind a future legislature by law, only in the Constitution.
This issue is supposed to be one of the very few that Governor Walker and his challenger Mary Burke agree on. Does that demonstrate, as far as you can see, that it does have the broad bipartisan appeal that's necessary to pass it?
Maybe, but it's kind of an easy call for them because it is out of their hands. I mean, once you go to a constitutional amendment process like this, you know, it needs to pass two consecutive sessions of the legislature. It doesn't really matter what a governor thinks about it, and it doesn't matter what a gubernatorial candidate thinks about it. It's out of their hands. So I think it's probably a safe call for them, and, you know, politically a safe call too, given that you know, the road building lobby is definitely a powerful one in Wisconsin, and one of those governors would, you know, want to be working with them rather than against them, you know, should they win in tomorrow.
Now, another critique of this going forward is that gas sales are flat. People are taking public transportation more often now, and that if it were passed, this would privilege, you know, other things over public transportation, which seems to be rising. How does that get talked about?
Well, I don't think the amendment itself necessarily prioritizes one kind of transportation over another. I think, you know, the issue you're raising there is something much more controversial than what's on the ballot here. I mean, everybody likes to line up and say, yeah, when you pay for your gas tax, that ought to go to roads. And so that's probably, you know, that's a reason you've seen this get such bipartisan support. But when it comes to how we're going to pay for roads and transit going forward, that's been a difficult question that the legislature and governor have chosen not to answer for several sessions now. And, you know, next session may be the time that they either have to answer it and find some kind of revenue to pay for their appetite for roads, because they seem to like to build them, or they're going to have to say, we're going to build less.
Now, based on polls, what do we expect as far as the likely passage or defeat of this?
I don't know. I mean, this is definitely an issue that's flown under the radar because, you know, you look at the governor's race, and that's kind of sucked up all the energy this election season, to the point that even a race for state attorney general, an important office, what I would think is a high-profile office, is being ignored. And so and you get down to a proposed constitutional amendment like this with, you know, wording that doesn't exactly roll off the tongue, and I don't know that there's been any comprehensive polling on this. I think that the Transportation Development Association, which is the group that's pushing for this amendment, has done its own polling and said that this polls pretty well, but you know, the most comprehensive poll we're going to see on this is going to come on Election Day.
Right. And if this passes tomorrow, what happens next?
There it is. It's done. That's kind of the end of the road for this. So this is something that the legislature initiated last session or two sessions ago. They voted on it again this session. It's in the public's hands. And once the public votes on this one way or another, you know, if they vote yes, the Constitution is amended. And what that means practically is that next session, any revenue that goes into the transportation fund is, you know, basically locked down there. The flip side of that is that the general fund is not protected in that way. And so you've seen in the past couple budgets money from the general fund now going into the transportation fund. So, you know, the transportation fund will enjoy protections that the rest of the state's money does not enjoy.
Well, Sean will be watching tomorrow, as will you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Sean Johnson, WPR State Capitol reporter, here to explain the transportation amendment on the ballot tomorrow.
The role of war correspondents and the dangers they face has been highlighted in the current conflicts in Iraq and Syria.
Videos showing beheadings of Western journalists by the group ISIS captured worldwide attention, and the absence of journalists in regions controlled by ISIS militants has created black holes of news coverage, according to the group Reporters Without Borders.
Lindsay Palmer researches the role of conflict correspondents. She's an assistant professor of journalism and mass communication at the UW-Madison. She joins us here in the studio. Lindsay, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So what is the value of having correspondents in conflict zones like Syria and Iraq?
Well, speaking especially from an ethical perspective, and this is an area that I study here at UW-Madison, it is really not ethical to not have correspondents in the conflict zone. And that's because simply if we're trying to envision a world where the best practices, and this is thinking of ethics in its applied sense, where the best practices internationally can be achieved in terms of geopolitics, then we need witnesses at these sites. We need people there who can show the rest of the world what's going on. Otherwise, it'd be way too easy for these things to be covered up.
And I've read people referencing the genocide in Rwanda as an example of what can happen when you don't have that international witness out there.
Exactly. I think that's one of the cases that gets cited most often. And there are a number of others. Think about Syria in 1982 compared with now, where we have not only professional war correspondents, but so many of these digital activists collaborating with them and helping to distribute the images of what's going on.
And we mentioned those black holes in ISIS-controlled regions in Iraq and Syria, and that a lot of times the only video we might see from a place like that is filmed by ISIS itself.
Yeah, and I think this is a real problem and a real question for people working within the field of professional journalism, but also in media studies. And, you know, on one side, you can sort of argue that it's good to have some kind of image to distribute in order to incite debate. But on the other hand, there does need to be a balance, especially when the images that are being distributed are salacious and are sort of publicizing a horribly private moment of death.
So without reporters, all we get is propaganda.
Yeah.
Potentially.
Yeah, potentially.
Now, is the work, I mean, we've seen these beheadings. These are not the first cases of journalists dying while covering a conflict. Is the work they do worth the risks they take?
I would absolutely argue that it is worth the risks that they take. And I think that a lot of journalists themselves would probably agree. I've interviewed a number of war correspondents for the research that I do. And every single one of them has said that without this work, the world would not know some of the atrocities that unfold. So if a few individuals, or actually unfortunately more and more individuals, according to Committee to Protect Journalists, if they have to risk their own lives in order to get this information out, then they view that as part of their calling, and that should be valued.
Now, here in the West, we often focus on the Western journalists themselves. I know you've written about the role of local people, stringers or fixers, I guess they're called, who work with correspondents. Who are they and what kind of things do they do?
these people really need a lot more attention from the popular media, from the general transnational public. These are the people who often live at the site to which the foreign correspondent may travel. They arrange interviews. They do translation work. Sometimes they conduct interviews themselves. And sometimes they're sent out to do all of the reporting simply because Western journalists deem that reporting to be too dangerous, as is often the case in Iraq. So they can be anything from a translator or a driver of a car to a surrogate, in a sense. And this labor that they do is highly dangerous to them. And that's something that I think does need a lot more discussion.
Are they injured? Do they die in the line of work?
More of them tend to die than these Western correspondents that get so much FaceTime in the media. If you look at the statistics over the course of the last several years in Syria, the vast majority of journalists that are recorded to have died in Syria are actually Syrian, and many of them work as fixers and stringers.
Not to diminish the risks that the Western war correspondents take, but when their job is done, they can leave. And the stringers, the fixers, this is where they live. Do they often face risks after the coverage has gone away?
This is one of the main problems that the fixers and stringers I have interviewed have brought up with me, and that's the fact that they can, on a smaller scale, face a great deal of tension with families and friends who, if they end up finding out that they were working with Western journalists, don't like that information. And on a larger scale, they can be tracked by government officials who wouldn't necessarily strike out in quite so overt a way at the visiting journalist, but would charge the local journalist with treason. So it's a really serious problem.
So is there talk among media outlets and war correspondents about ethical responsibility toward these local journalists?
I think that the conversation is moving in that direction. There's certainly talk on sites like Reporters Without Borders and the Committee to Protect Journalists. But I think that it's really an area that needs far more discussion. And part of the problem is that journalists and their news outlets a lot of times don't like to go into detail about the level of collaboration that's involved in reporting. This is a problem also with stringers, with freelancers, especially freelance photographers who won't get credited for the work they do. So that's one problem. And then also this way of looking at fixers as though they're outsourced labor. And because of that, news outlets don't really feel that they're responsible for their safety, their contractual labor in that sense. So I think that that's something that really needs to be revised as much as possible.
That's interesting. I mean, if you are a local journalist, driver, photographer, translator, you name it, you're not going to get much of the glory. It sounds like you're not going to get paid much. Have you heard much about what motivates people in this position?
Well, some of the people who I've spoken with have said that what motivates them is the possibility of eventually becoming professional journalists. A few others have said that they love the translative work. They like being able to kind of build that bridge between cultures. And then others do have the sort of political interest in the sense that they just want the story to be told in some way or another.
That they want to help bear witness and help the rest of the world know what's going on?
Yeah, they want to do their part in that witnessing.
Now, turning back to the war correspondents from the West, you've talked to a bunch of them, and something I wonder is, I will probably never do something like this, but if I did, I'd think, well, how would I talk to my wife about that and my kids and explain the risk? Is this a conflict that they have that they grapple with?
I think so. I mean, there's a great deal of this exact problem surfacing in the memoirs that you'll read by war correspondents and the articles they'll write for various publications and, of course, also in the interviews that I've conducted. Some of them claim that really you can't have a personal life, that this has to envelop everything. And others have successfully been able to do this. But I think it maybe depends on the individual and the types of relationships that they build.
And this probably applies not just to conflict, but I've heard interviews with journalists talking about going back to Liberia for a second stint covering the Ebola crisis and trying to figure out, how do I do this in a way that doesn't put my family at risk?
Yeah, I think that it really isn't unique to war coverage, but it's very much an issue of putting oneself in some kind of risk. So even disaster reporting, going to report on natural disasters, that can be another problem like that.
So are there differences if, say, somebody works for a news network or BBC or New York Times versus, I know a lot of freelance reporters are out there trying to cover conflict zones.
I think the difference is for freelancers is just the intense amount of competition that they face and the fact that they are rarely protected by those news organizations who will tell them not to go somewhere because they can't insure them, but then will reward them by buying their story once they go ahead and go. So there's just that lack of safety and protection that staffers have, I think.
And is there a sense that if the affiliated reporter is taken hostage or something or held in North Korea, somebody might help them get out? The freelancer has nothing like that waiting for them.
Yeah, that's generally the understanding. And I think that, you know, on some level, there have been times when, you know, for freelancers, their families and their colleagues have gotten together to try to help them. But the amount of pull that's involved is very different. We saw Richard Engel get kidnapped in Syria, and he was, you know, he's an NBC celebrity, and he was able to get out of that situation. But then you see someone like James Foley and Stephen Sotloff, and the situation was very different for them.
So this is a potentially very risky profession. Again, you've talked to a lot of these war correspondents. Are there things about, I don't know, their personality that you've noticed that they have in common that leads them to do this?
Well, I wouldn't want to necessarily comment on their personality or their psychological makeup or anything like that. I can only go on what they've told me. And almost as a rule, I've spoken at this point with 54 different correspondents. And as a rule, they've told me that they are a misfit and that you have to be a misfit in order to do this kind of work. Or they've used the word maverick as well. So there's kind of this way of not identifying with the status quo that can be, in their eyes, both a good thing and a bad thing at the same time.
Briefly, we hear about cuts to investigative reporting funding, science reporting, environmental reporting. Is the same thing true with conflict reporting? Are there just cutbacks in what papers outlets will pay for?
Yeah, there's an amazing amount of cutbacks. I mean, we've seen the closure of foreign bureaus around the world, really starting even back in the 80s, and especially intensifying throughout the 90s and then the 21st century. And what's happening is that the correspondents themselves are being asked to do the work that entire news bureaus would have done before. We're also seeing the rise of parachute journalism, which has a lot of problems because of the fact that these people don't often know the language in the place where they're going. They don't have that much background, and they haven't had enough time to really know the story and understand what it is.
We'll leave it there for now. Lindsay, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That's Lindsay Palmer, Assistant Professor of Journalism and Mass Communication at the UW-Madison.